D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal. Rein in den Elfenbeinturm. Es gilt das gesprochene Wort. In Universitäten, Akademien und Forschungszentren. Die großen Köpfe der Vergangenheit. Die besten Hirne der Gegenwart.
Mit Sibylle Salewski. Gleich zu Beginn seiner Amtszeit, da nahm sich US-Präsident Barack Obama eines lang schwelenden und heiß umstrittenen Problems an, des maroden Gesundheitssystems der USA. Es kostete die Demokraten dann tatsächlich enorme Zugeständnisse und Kompromisse, auch nur Teile der von ihnen angestrebten Gesundheitsreform durchzusetzen. Zu tief verlaufen in den USA die Gräben zwischen den Anhängern staatlicher Regulierungen und den Verfechtern eines freien Marktes. In unserem Vortrag heute hier im D-Radio Wissen Hörsaal geht es um die Probleme, die entstehen, wenn man die Mechanismen des freien Marktes auf Krankenversicherungen anwendet. Sick Insurance – Adverse Selection and Regulation of Health Insurance Markets lautet der Titel. Gehalten hat den Vortrag der Wirtschaftsnobelpreisträger Daniel McFadden am 26. August vergangenen Jahres beim 4. Treffen der Wirtschaftsnobelpreisträger in Lindau am Bodensee. Daniel McFadden ist Professor an der University of California at Berkeley. Nebenbei ist er auch noch Landwirt. 5 Kühe besitzt McFadden, 3 Enten, 11 Hühner. Dazu dann auch noch einen kleinen Weinberg. Das sei ein großartiger Ort, sagt McFadden, um Beweise für seine Theorien zu finden.
Heterogeneity in consumer tastes and needs and in cost and quality of goods and services are ubiquitous features of resource allocation. But as long as these are publicly observable, markets can price, sort, and match the variations efficiently. For example, for insurance, which is what I'm going to concentrate on today, you can have an efficient insurance market where there is no private information that allows people on one side of the market to improve on the prediction of expected benefits based on public information. If you have those circumstances, then you can have competitive underwriting in which the prices of insurance contracts are set at their actuarial value plus a competitively determined load, and that market will operate efficiently. And incidentally, an essential aspect of a well-working insurance market in that form is that issues like the ability of insurers to reprice contracts or to cancel coverage if a buyer has a bad experience are clauses that will themselves be negotiated in the competitive market as contract terms, and they will be appropriately priced. Now, an example of an insurance market which does not satisfy these conditions is the market for health insurance. And there are a number of reasons. It's a perfect storm of market failure. There are various sources for this. One, which I'll talk about subsequently, is that there may be social sentiment for ex post equity or fairness, and those can conflict with what would ordinarily be a perfectly legitimate and efficient market outcome. That is to say, you can have an efficient market outcome which is socially unacceptable, and the response to that may be, in fact, to then upset the market, perhaps appropriately, but nevertheless, it's a problem to deal with. Other issues in this market arise from asymmetric information, and they are the classic problems of adverse selection, where people are denied coverage or offered actuarially very unfair contracts because of the possibility that they are bad risks. Moral hazard, where coverage just becomes very expensive because providers lack incentives to minimize treatment costs or withhold unproductive treatments. It's part of a principal agent problem. Performance risk, in which insurers evade paying benefits by making contract enforcement costly. A general problem in contract theory where you have asynchronous operations of the transaction. And finally, signaling and screening as a device used by market participants to avoid either being lumped in together with high-risk peers or having to pay benefits to high-risk people. Let me say first something about the problem of social unacceptability of market outcomes, that particularly issue for health insurance. So consumers in society have difficulty refusing or withholding treatment after bad health outcomes are realized. There's a social sentiment for ex post equity, and this can conflict with competitive underwriting. A good example is that if someone has kidney failure, they're very expensive to treat. The social sentiment is that as a human right, they're entitled to treatment at some affordable cost. Now, the problem of conflicts between what's socially acceptable and market outcomes could probably be taken care of if consumers could acquire unconditional lifetime health insurance ex ante before their health status is ever determined. And if they chose not to buy health insurance, they commit irrevocably to the consequences of having limited ability to pay. But neither of those conditions are met in reality. A consequence of that is that it's often the practice in health insurance and in other areas to forbid competitive underwriting on the basis of some criteria with the objective of trying to mitigate market outcomes that are deemed unfair. For example, it's often in health insurance a rule which prohibits discrimination on the basis of gender or on the basis of pre-existing conditions. Now, from an economic point of view, if the regulation requires these kinds of non-discrimination rules, and that results in coverage for high-risk consumers at less than their actuarial value, then the unintended consequence is that unless the market is subsidized, the premiums for the low-risk consumers are going to have to rise above their actuarial value. They will be penalized, and there is effectively an income transfer from the low-risk to the high-risk consumers. And this, in turn, can induce a form of adverse selection. It's now not coming from asymmetric information, but simply from social regulation to try to assure fair outcomes. Very difficult to have the interpersonal transfers required to achieve this level of fairness in a system that does not itself introduce substantial market distortions of the type just mentioned. So very careful regulation is needed to try to deal with these issues of social fairness. Asymmetric information is the most common reason cited for failures in insurance markets and in particular health insurance markets, and they are these classic triumvirate, adverse selection, moral hazard, and performance risk or counterparty risk. There's a long history in economics and pre-economics of attention to these sources. This is a very, very old subject, and partisans of market solutions who think carefully about it, you need to think seriously about whether you're in a market situation where these problems can be overcome or whether something substantive has to be done to overcome them. There's a lot of other literature on markets under incomplete or asymmetric information, and I'm not going to spend time going through this, but if you flash some names there, you might recognize some of them. One comment, I'm talking about health insurance here today specifically, but many insurance markets and markets which basically just depend on contracts share many of these same problems. Labor markets and markets for financial derivatives, which are insurance contracts, have problems that are quite similar to those that arise in the health insurance market. I'm going to remind you of some price theory that I believe everyone has seen in their first graduate class in economics, and these are some diagrams from Rothschild-Stiglitz. I would be cautious about putting up diagrams, but in this case, you've all seen these before, so I just want to remind you quickly of what happens in an insurance market with asymmetric information. So here's a diagram with contingent commodities, the consumption of healthy or consumption of sick, and there is an endowment point in which the person will have less resources to consume, will incur a loss if they're sick. The loss is in red here, loss L. The 45-degree line corresponds to equal consumption in either state. The budget line in this case is the locus of actuarially fair trades, That is to say, insurance contracts, which will break even for the insurer. And when individuals are risk-averse, expected utility maximizers, the slope of their indifference curve at the 45-degree line gives the odds of being sick. And if you have actuarially fair insurance, there is an optimal contract, in this case, located at a little arrow from full insurance, you'll have full insurance. So that would be the point in which this particular consumer would locate. Very standard analysis. This works perfectly well if there's more than one class of consumers. So you could have robust consumers and frail consumers. The frail consumers have a higher probability of getting sick. And if their risk class were observable, then the market would simply offer two insurance contracts, F and R. Each would get full insurance and at premiums which reflect the actuarially fair cost of insuring against their losses. Now, suppose that the risk class of the consumers is not observable, so that when an insurer offers a contract, he does not know ex ante whether the buyer is robust or frail. In this circumstance, one possibility is that all consumers, both frail and robust, would buy a contract. And in this case, you may get a locus of actuarially fair contracts, which in this diagram is labeled the all-in break-even contracts. And that's simply an average of the break-even budget lines for the two classes. The location of the average will depend on how commonly people are robust or frail. In this diagram, I've labeled what I call a candidate pooling contract. This would be a contract which is break-even for a competitive insurer if it was in fact purchased by all people. A detail on that, this is just a blow-up so you can see a little better what's going on. That particular contract, pooling contract P, is located at a point of tangency between the robust consumer's indifference curve and the actuarially fair line or the break-even line for pooled contracts. And that contract P then has the property that robust consumers would choose not to move. The higher risk consumers, the frail consumers, would like to buy more at that price, but that's in this case not being offered. In the market, there would be no incentive for an insurer to offer a broader coverage because only the frail would buy it and it would not break even. But this candidate cannot survive as a Nash equilibrium. The reason is that there are blocking contracts. In this case, it's denoted in this diagram by a little blue dot. And it's a contract located in the area which is better for the robust but worse for the frail. So what would happen is in the existence of the contract P, if an insurance company now offered the blocking contract, it could entice away all of the robust consumers from which it could then break even or better and leave behind all of the frail consumers at P, in which case P would no longer break even and equilibrium would break down. So this is the original Rothschild-Stiglitz argument that a pooling equilibrium cannot exist. Another possibility that they consider that occurs in these markets is a so-called separating equilibrium where each risk class will have its own policy, and the policies now are positioned in commodity space in such a way that the high-risk consumers will not be tempted to try to misrepresent themselves as robust consumers and move to the contract being purchased by the robust group. And in detail, you get a diagram which looks like this. The frail consumers are getting full insurance at a high premium, actuarially fair premium. The robust consumers are getting partial insurance, and with the location of that being such that R is not a utility improvement for the frail consumers, so they have no positive incentive to move away from F to R. Now, in the diagram as drawn here, note that the indifference curve of the robust consumers does not intersect the all-in break-even contract. And if you do a little analysis, as Rothschild and Stiglitz do, the result is that F&R, in this case, is a stable Nash equilibrium. However, and this is just a question of the proportions of frail and robust consumers and the nature of the difference curves of the robust consumers, you could also have a situation in which the indifference curve of the robust consumers through the separating contract R cuts the break-even contract line, in which case there's now a blocking pooling contract. Now, the pooling contract cannot itself be in equilibrium, we already know that, but it's enough to block this separating equilibrium. And in this case, no Nash equilibrium in this market will necessarily exist. So the conclusions of that classic study are that when consumers know their risk class and insurers cannot distinguish risk classes, and in a competitive market, any contract which is defined by its premium and its coverage can be offered, then either there's a separating Nash equilibrium in which robust consumers are only partially insured, or there's no Nash equilibrium at all. It's also known from literature about the same time that if the risk classes are very closely spaced or are, in the worst case, a continuum of risk classes, then there is no Nash equilibrium. It will always break down. It is possible that there are non-Nash or higher-order conjecture equilibria in these markets. That was a result of Wilson, but I'm not going to concentrate on that. So what I do in the paper that I'm discussing today asks the following question. If you have an insurance market like the health insurance market with asymmetric information where the market either unravels or achieves a very inefficient separating equilibrium, what kinds of market organizations or regulations can be used to mitigate the effects of asymmetric information and achieve stability in relative or some second-order efficiency? As a general problem, this is a problem of applied mechanism design, and you can consider three kinds of elements: consumer, insurer, and our market interventions to control adverse selection, other problems that don't show up in Rothschild-Stiglitz but are present in this market, incentive designs to control moral hazard from consumers and from providers of health services, and finally, capital and conduct requirements to control performance or counterparty risk. Because I have limited time, I'm going to give you one extremely simple regulatory scheme which solves the adverse selection problem. Suppose that you regulate this market by restricting the kinds of coverage that contracts offered in the market can provide. Specifically, consider fixed coverage regulation. It says that if there's a lost capital L associated with sickness, then the only contracts that will be allowed by the regulators in the market will be ones that cover a specified share theta of that loss. Once that coverage level is specified, the contract terms are specified, then the premiums can then be determined competitively in the market. So consider a market like that. Suppose you have competitive insurers. Suppose you have free entry and exit of insurers. And initially, I'm going to go to the best case first. Suppose you have fixed coverage at a level that would obtain the same pooled contract that we previously said could not be a Nash equilibrium because it was blocked. And now, if we just go back to the case of the pooled equilibrium, we'll see that this simple regulation is enough to restore Nash equilibrium within this regulated market. The contracts that are now allowed effectively, is the contract that's allowed is a contract which corresponds to P. Competition would allow other contracts which are identical to that in terms of the loss covered, but would vary in premium. And those correspond to a 45-degree line, which is just a affine translation of the 45-degree line. So along that line labeled fixed coverage various premiums, those are the contracts that could exist in this market. It's very easy to see, elementary to see, that P is, in this case, has to be a Nash equilibrium. It has to exist. Effectively, the intersection of the all-in break-even contract line, the actuarially fair contracts, and the fixed coverage line determine the Nash equilibrium. And with a little geometric argument, you can easily convince yourself that there are no longer any possible blocking contracts. So in this case, there is no adverse selection. By restricting the kinds of contracts that can be offered, you've managed to corral all consumers to purchase this. The blocking contract that was shown here, the contract that was shown here that cannot be blocked was not one with full coverage, but it could have been. One could actually have full coverage. In that case, the robust consumer would actually prefer a little less. The frail consumer would prefer a little more, but with no ability of the insurers to modify contract terms or offer alternative contract forms, there's no possibility that they could block. Now, if one's going to use this device, one has to be rather careful about where one locates the fixed or minimum coverage level. If you have a lower level of minimum coverage than that P, you get back into a situation where you can have non-existence of equilibrium, or you can have a separating equilibrium. In that case, the robust consumers are either at the coverage limit, or you're actually back into the case of a classic Rothschild-Stiglitz separating equilibrium. But the main point here is by regulating the kinds of products that are offered in the market, one is able to bring adverse selection under control. And in fact, it's very difficult, although there are many, many ways to regulate an insurance market, it's very difficult to avoid the problem of adverse selection, at least with a continuum of risk classes of consumers, without some kind of regulation. Product form, essentially of the kinds of contracts on which competition is permitted. I have about 3 minutes left. I'm going to just give you a quick list of some of the kinds of regulatory techniques that are used. I'm not even going to describe how they work. Some work well, some work less well. My research program is to try to determine exactly which ones work best. I mean, it's kind of the insurance market equivalent of determining an optimal voting rule. The question is, among all the forms of regulation, are there regulatory devices which are in some sense second best? On the consumer side, you can have coverage mandates. You can require people to buy insurance. You can subsidize their premiums, perhaps through using vouchers. If they have low income, you can subsidize their premiums. And for the control of moral hazard, you can have co-payments. You can have what are called reference price benefits, which say that for any given condition, the insurance pays the least cost-effective available therapy, and anything above that, the consumers are on their own. That has some very nice optimality properties from the standpoint of getting the incentive structure for consumers right. And you can have various kinds of prohibitions on overinsurance, something that's really necessary when moral hazard is a problem and something which it was markedly missing from the derivatives market, the market for financial insurance, where people were able to greatly overinsure with disastrous results. You can regulate insurers. Contract control, like fixed or minimum coverage, that's the case that I've already discussed, various kinds of contract entry restrictions. You can have premium regulation. Generally does not work very well. You can have limits on administrative load, also a little bit invasive, but maybe necessary. You can have operating subsidies. That is to say, a lot of the cost of the benefits, or some portion share of them, are provided through public funds, not through premiums. And that those can be effective. And the reason that such operating subsidies can be effective is that with a sufficient subsidy, then the premium that any consumer sees will be at least as favorable as the actuarially fair contract, so they have no reason not to buy the insurance, and the result will be that you will get pooling equilibrium with adequate subsidies. You can have enrollment controls, which have the effect of eliminating wasteful screening and signaling activities. You can have rescission control, that is to say non-cancellation policies. You can have risk adjustment, which is an ex-ante way of trying to correct an insurer's benefit obligations for the risk characteristics of its clientele. Experience adjustment, which does the same thing ex post. There are principal agent problems and tenant problems and all of these. There's reinsurance, which is essentially another way of subsidizing insurance companies, particularly against high-risk people. To control moral hazard, you can use capitation, what's called an accountable care incentives, which is to reward on the basis of outcomes, not on the basis of procedures. You can have capital requirements and controls on benefit management to try to control counterparty risk. You can also intervene at the level of the market. You can reorganize these markets as single-payer or government-managed markets, and in effect, that's a direct and perhaps heavy-handed way of being able to restricting the contracts that are offered. You can have dual public-private systems in which the public system is charged with being an exemplar or a competitive limit on an otherwise private market by setting reference contracts and premiums. And finally, a device that's actually interesting for economists to study, you can use various kinds of incentive-compatible bidding mechanisms as part of an industry subsidy to try to avoid some of the adverse incentive problems there. One final comment, and that is that there are a number of behavioral considerations in insurance markets that have to do with what consumers think and what they believe about their risks. Individual risk perceptions may be inaccurate. There are very few market mechanisms that would discipline individuals if they make mistakes about their own risk. One is may misperceive their average risk. Second, may misperceive the dispersion, possible dispersion risk, how much risk there really is. Both of those things can really foul up the operation of an insurance market, even if there were no other problems of asymmetric information and so forth. If individuals cannot get it right, markets can go south. There's actually an important comment here, which has much broader application, which is that our whole theory of efficient markets and the rationale in economics for the use of markets is predicated on the assumption that consumers can do their part of the bargain, can respond in their own self-interest, can respond to incentives, and can give the signals through demand and through voting with their feet that are necessary to drive that market to efficient allocations. If consumers fail to do these things, then you can get bad results from a market. That doesn't necessarily mean the government can do it better, but it does mean that private markets are not doing it well. This is all I'm going to have time for today. Perhaps there'll be a few more slides this afternoon. I got you up to the late 70s in this problem, but work goes on. And there are very interesting economic issues in applied mechanism design in this area. And I would encourage those of you who have some interest in this topic to read in particular about the U.S. market for prescription drug insurance, which is a controversial, innovative, and surprisingly successful attempt to use mechanism design theory to design a private market that does a reasonably good job in resource allocation in the health area. Thank you very much.
Der Wirtschaftsnobelpreisträger Daniel McFadden über die Schwierigkeiten, Krankenversicherungen dem freien Spiel von Angebot und Nachfrage zu überlassen. McFadden hat seinen Vortrag am 26. August vergangenen Jahres gehalten, beim vierten Treffen der Wirtschaftsnobelpreisträger in Lindau am Bodensee.
D-Radio Wissen. D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.